You know, what's interesting about these musicians didn't know what they were going to play. The engineer didn't know what they were going to play.
And look how it came out.
Yeah, that's because you have to listen.
I neglected to mention that the Miles Davis cut is from an album called Someday My Prince Will Come. And this is from an album called Straight No Chaser. That was actually not on the original album. It's an example of one of these previously unissued takes that you get on these reissue box sets that are so great. You know, the stuff that's been sitting in the vault since 1967. This was an Armenian church at
yes.
one time. Huh? What was it, about 49 that Columbia acquired this space?
Yes.
This building?
Yes. Yeah. Didn't look like a church at all.
I think we saw...
Yeah, look, you saw one picture of it.
Yeah.
And that's what it looked like until you stepped in, and it was great. Yeah. Now, what we just heard there was no music. They just played what they heard, and they responded back and forth. Also, I didn't get any cues from anyone. So you have to pay attention, you have to listen. And listen and remember, because if they rehearse them when they're recording it, and you don't remember what they were doing, you're going to be caught in the middle. So it's not only listening, it's also paying attention to what you're doing. Any of you go on there, I don't know what the industry is today, but I was in the middle of the best period of music this country ever heard, and I was so thrilled.
When you know, people like Miles and Monk were almost as famous for their various personality issues
yes.
and lifestyle issues and things as they were for their artistry. What were they like to work with in the studio?
Well, neither one of them did much talking. Monk never spoke. Didn't speak to his musicians, didn't speak to me. I did many sessions, not a word was spoken. Miles was somewhat, but Miles was also a forceful guy. When he looked at one of his boys that they didn't follow what he wanted, they knew it. I mean, he was on top of them all the time without being vocal. And when I first started, I was told, recording with him, you are not going to like him. He's a nasty son of a bitch. And I said, oh, really? Okay. He and I became the best of friends. He appreciated that I was enjoying his music and that I really was serious. And that's the reason I appreciated him, too. So we got along famously, really. We finally split when he went electronic. I hate to use that word, but that's the way it went. I did his first album.
Bitches Brew?
Huh?
Was it Bitches Brew?
I don't think it was
Bitches. In a Silent Way? Is that the one?
Maybe. I don't recall.
The first electronic one, you mean?
Huh?
The first electronic one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I sat through three sessions. I was worn out. When it was all over, Miles came in and said, thank you. Did you enjoy it? I looked at him. I said, Miles, you and I are good friends. Don't ever forget it. Did I enjoy it? No. I disliked it. I said, it hurt me to sit here and listen to that. So if ever you get back to doing acoustic, please call me. I'm ready. And so we stayed good friends.
But you only recorded. I think it must have been Bitches Brew.
It could have been. I don't, you know, titles never. Crossed my mind too much. So, well, are we boring everyone? Should we give them a break?
Well, the next thing I wanted to talk about was to talk specifically about some of the vocal albums.
Okay.
And some of the vocal recordings. You have said, when Mitch and I worked on a new singer, we'd usually spend the first session just developing a sound for them, including
yes.
which microphone, as well as EQ settings mm-hmm. and echo. Once we got that, it went into my logbook, and Mitch always said not to change anything. Another related quote again from the ever-useful David Simons. He said, with Frank Laco, Miller crafted Columbia's instantly recognizable vocal sound, its greatest legacy. And, of course, that signature vocal sound, somewhere in his book, or maybe it's in an article in Mix Magazine, it talks about how it's, at Christmas time it's kind of hard to turn on the radio without hearing a song that Frank Laco engineered because of all the hit Christmas albums on Columbia in that era. But a large part of that signature vocal sound had to do with that use of echo. Now, you mentioned, this is interesting because I didn't know it, that Tio, for example, one of the whole reasons why that piece just grabs you from the opening notes, I think, is your sense of music in a particular
yeah.
actual space,
mm-hmm.
right? And that was done simply from the room ambience, not through the use of echo.
No.
But
no.
with the vocal recordings, you did use
yes.
echo often, and those echo chambers at 30th Street Studio became rather famous in themselves. Can you talk a little bit about what you did and,
they
and
did.
How that happened?
Because I did. Even the English engineers and producers come in to listen and to find out what I was doing. And I wasn't doing anything that was exciting. But that room, you didn't have to do much with it. But when you did it, something, it had to belong. It's almost like you can't put something here that doesn't fit. It has to fit. And so, well, I looked around. Mitch was great for Echo. He loved it. So I said to him one time, I said, you know, I think he told me once that Les Paul, I don't know if that's a name you all know, okay, did a certain kind of echo in his place. And I admired Les Paul like he was God. Oh, I said, how can we find out? He said, well, we'll go up and visit him. So we did, you know. And Les lived in Mahwah, New Jersey. So we went up, and what he did was different, not just the echo, but the output of the chamber. He ran through another tape, recorded on another tape, and blended the two of them so that you could get... The echo just continued, whereas if you just do the studio echo and even straight adding tape echo, it stops once you've... So that's what Les Paul did. He extended it by recording the output of the echo onto another tape or onto the same tape if you were doing live. And you just never knew that it was echo chamber. It was in and out. It all fit hand in.
It was organic. Huh?
Yeah, it was great. And I certainly didn't do it. Les Paul did it. But I asked him if he'd be upset. He said, not a bit. I'm not going to tell anyone. So he said, so I continued to use it. It's great. And when I left, you know, Johnny Mathis, for one, said, hey, I want to do an album with you. I said, oh, yeah, where? Well, we'll do it right at 30th Street. I said, no, we won't. I won't do that. If you want, I'll record you somewhere else, but I'm never going to give you the 30th Street sound that we developed. Wouldn't be fair to CBS or me. So I said, no. So I did one album with them, and I don't even remember where, but it was not the same because you can't get that same sound anywhere else. So we did it, you know.
How were the echo chambers set up at 30th Street?
Well, most of the guys were using the electronic ones. I can't even remember their names anymore. The boxes. Yeah, thank you. And I just never enjoyed that. I couldn't get to feel comfortable with it. So I walked around and went down into the basement. You know, on 7th Avenue, we would use the stairwell, which was a great chamber, but you had to start work at 12 midnight in order to use it. And... So I went down to the basement area, opened doors that had not been opened forever. Here's this room, from that wall to maybe that piece there and across. And I thought, and it was live, I thought, why can't we use this? So that's when I got help with my fellow engineers, and we took microphones, stand, speakers, and tried. Move them here, there, and everywhere, and change the microphones. Then we got exactly what I thought we should use. I called Mitch Miller. I said, I think we have something. You want to come down anytime and pay attention and listen? Sure, sure. So he was sold. And I had to mark every marking on the floor and measure the microphone height. Oh, I tell you. And so I did it very willingly because I heard exactly what he heard, and I was happy, so that's the way it went. And it never changed. We had the engineers from England coming and listening, and I don't know how you do it. Well, of course, I wasn't going to tell them where I was getting the chamber. I said, you just listen, that's all you have to do. So that's the way we lived it.
One of those English engineers that he's referring to is a man, a very well-known engineer named Malcolm Addy.
Yes, Malcolm was one of them.
Who is well-known because he recorded the Beatles.
Right.
And he said that he visited the 30th Street Studio to try to learn how Frank Laco got that sound and to try to achieve that kind of echo balance for the Beatles. He said he thinks he got close but never quite got there.
Yeah. We became good friends.
I'm sorry?
You asked him about the Beatles.
Thank you.
Uh-oh. Maybe I should pull mine off.
No.
I'm sitting on it is the reason. Maybe that's a good opportunity to hear an example of this vocal sound that was, in the opinion of Simons and I think other people, Columbia's greatest legacy. This is a track for which I will not take personal responsibility for its selection. I don't know if I've ever heard this one before. This was chosen by that famous audiophile and music devotee, Rick Chin. And it is a singer that I think in the minds of most people who know something about Frank's career, if there's one artist of all the great ones he worked with that's you most associate with Frank, it's Tony Bennett.
Oh, yes.
And this is a piece that hopefully will give you all a real good sense of what we're talking about when we talk about Columbia's greatest legacy in terms of this vocal sound. This is a song called East of the Sun.
Oh, yeah.
Tony Bennett.
I wish that we could live up in the sky, where we could find a place away up high. Live among the stars, the sun, the moon, just you and I, east of the sun and west of the moon. We'll build a dream house of love, dear. Sun in the day, near to the moon at night, we'll live in a lovely way.
Listening to it in this room, it sounds like too much echo.
Maybe this room has a
yeah.
Just you and I. the day. Love will not die, we'll keep it that way. Up among the stars, we'll find a harmony of life to a lovely tune. East of the sun and west of the moon.
I've had a few brief contacts with Tony Bennett myself. As Mike mentioned, I worked for many years for Magnolia Hi-Fi. Magnolia Hi-Fi in the year 2000 was purchased by Best Buy. And that Christmas, December of 2000, the management of Magnolia, the three of us, were invited to the Best Buy officers' Christmas party, because we were technically now officers of Best Buy. It was sort of like being like a Lithuanian generals at like a meeting of the Red Army or something. But technically, we were officers of the corporation, and so we were invited to the officers' Christmas party, which was held at it was an annual event held at a very fancy country club near Minneapolis, where their corporate headquarters are, and where the entertainment that first year that I went to their Christmas party in a room of 200 people and 100 officers and their 100 spouses was Tony Bennett. And it was amazing to be in a room that small with him. I was just recently in New York and did an article for Stereophile involving my getting into several different recording studios, and one of which was Bennett Studios. I think, partly out of frustration of not being able to work with Frank anymore, he built his own studio, and he has his son engineer stuff now.
Yes.
Dave Bennett is the chief engineer there, a very, very nice studio that does a lot of work with jazz. I've read in various places some of your stories about the session at which I Left My Heart in San Francisco was recorded, and it was interesting. What do you remember about that session? Because it's a historic occasion, after all.
I remember it very clearly. Mitch was excited. In those days, he recorded four tunes in 3 hours. So Mitch came in, he said, we're gonna start with San Francisco. That's the song. That's the song. Okay. So Tony comes in, gets started. Mitch says, we'll start with San Francisco. No, I don't want to do it. Mitch looked like he got kicked where he shouldn't have been. So, okay. So we did whatever the first tune was then, became whatever number, it became number one. We did that. And Mitch said, okay, now we'll do Frisco. No, we're not going to do Frisco. Now Mitch is really chewing on his cigar. So he looked at me, he said, that son of a bitch. I said, well, maybe best wait. So we did the third tune. Now Tony says, well, that's it. Let's call it a night. That's enough. And Mitch, with that, got up. He said, he called him quite a number of names. Said, Frank, you take over. You produce San Francisco. I looked at him. I said, are you serious? He said, yes. I said, okay. So I went down and told Tony that Mitch has left, had a previous engagement. All right. So I said, listen, why don't we do Frisco? Just us. All right, if you want, let's try. So we did a take. He said, "That's it." And I said, "I really don't think so, Tony. You know, I'm on your side, and I wouldn't let you put this kind of a take out. Oh, all right, if you think I can do better." So we did it a second time. Again, he said, "That's it." I said, "I think you have one more in you." We did it, and that was it. Right straight through. Nothing was done to it again. And he didn't like the song, right? You heard that, didn't you? Now it's his favorite song. See? So who knows when there's a hit in the wings. So,
but no, it was his idea.
Yeah.
let's hear that. Can we hear that, Rick?
Oh, you're going to play it? Oh, yeah.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going home.
This was about 2 a.m. New York time.
30th Street.
We started at 11.
I left my heart in San Francisco.
And these guys are there. They're there. This isn't played. This isn't dubbed in later. They're
no,
there.
It's all live.
Everything. It calls to me to be where little cable cars.
And in those days, they worked on diction. Today, you can't understand a word.
But now you've got every word is precise.
Never recorded that song again until, 2 years ago or so. He made an album of duets. Bennett did a big hit in his 80th year, duets with Bono and Katie Lang and stuff, and he recorded a duet with Bill Charlotte, the piano player, and re-recorded San Francisco. I would assisted on an interview for Jazz Times that Bill Charlotte did with Tony Bennett. Charlotte was sort of a technophobe, and Jazz Times was afraid that he'd blow the recording, also that he'd freeze up in the interview, so they wanted somebody else there. So I essentially just sat there and recorded it. But he said in that interview he thinks he's now sang that song 10,000 times. Mm. He sang it, of course, at the Best Buy Christmas party, and it was probably one of the few audiences that he ever performed for that was so unhip, these lovely Best Buy multi-millionaire executives, that he broke into the verse and there was no applause. You could tell he was kind of, because when he starts San Francisco, the audience is supposed to applaud. You know, the Best Buy guys just sort of sat there.
Just looking at him.
He sang the song anyway. One question that I was curious about, when I was going through discographies and stuff, I was puzzled by like Miles Davis. They would have one album we were engineered by you. Next album by Fred Plaut. Next album by maybe Harold Chapman. Next album by you again. How did they decide who was to do what sessions? Almost like whoever was working that night or something? I mean,
well, basically, as far as engineers are concerned, the producers usually made their choice if you were available. And if not, then the next one would do it. That's what happens. Oftentimes, I was doing other sessions, so I couldn't do the next Miles or whatever. And that was the reason.
I see.
Yeah.
I read that you said that the day that they tore that studio down, the 33rd studio down in 1982, was the saddest day of your life.
Yes.
Is that, tell us a little bit about that. Is that when you left Columbia?
Shortly after that. Oh, I had left Columbia. That's right. Because I knew that Sony was coming in, and then I thought, I don't want to start all over again with a whole new concept. I was ready to get out because I knew the studio was going, and so I left. And then it was sold a couple months after I left CBS. And then when I heard of it, I had called Mitch to let him know about it. He knew that it was on the market. I said, can't you get a group together and we go in and run it ourselves? No, I said, don't want to do that now. Mm. So we didn't do it. Mm. But
thought about it, but didn't do it.
Yeah, he had thought about it too. So it was a pity because it was a real landmark for the music industry. You know, it should have been contained instead of allowed to get sold for peanuts.
What are maybe a couple of, with all the extraordinary people that you work with, what are maybe, is there maybe a couple of memories that stand out in your mind when you think back on those days, something we haven't touched on yet, or an artist that we haven't touched on that occurs to you, or is it?
Well, there are quite a number of them. I don't want to sound conceited, but I mean, I started Barbara Streisand, and she came into the studio and I looked, I thought, what the hell is this? What can you do with that? But I got her into the studio and I set her up and I told her what to do and stay there, don't move around. Okay. And she opened up her mouth and I got goosebumps. I was completely taken in. And so we did the three sessions. And when it was over, now, mind you, her manager and she didn't have a word to say except how nice everything was, right? So when it was all over, they said, well, what do you think? I said, I think it's a hit record. Well, how many? I said, I have no idea about counting records. That's not my function. I said, I think it's a hit record and no reason why it couldn't be a big one. Well, two of them said, if it is, you have yourself a new car. So I looked at them and grinned and I said, I wish you hadn't said that. Because I have four or five out there waiting for me, and I haven't arrived yet. So they caught on real quick. I never did get the car, never. She became a big star and a big pain, you know where. Terrible person, but a great singer. Those are the stories you don't usually hear, so. But don't take it out too far now. At least don't quote me if you want to tell it. Because she promised to sue me once because I was quoted in a book that was written about her. And it was the truth. We did an album of her hit songs in different languages. And she said, it went so easy, it was so... And I said, it went easy, hell, it took well over a year before we finally got the last bit. We would put it together piece by piece because she couldn't, her whatever language it was at the time. And that's the way it went. If you saw that tape going through the heads, all you saw was white. So she called me home, at home on a Saturday, and really chewed me out. And I said, listen, Barbara, don't go crazy. I'm not telling anything that wasn't true. All you and your lawyer have to do, go to CBS, ask to see the workbooks that we fill in. And it's all there. Oh, yeah, well, you shouldn't have. Well, now that's something else. I agree I shouldn't have, but I did. So it stayed in the book. She didn't sue me. She never said a nice word either. So.
Well, I think it is time for a break. And, when we reconvene, we will open the floor up to you guys. Okay?
Thank you. All right. Okay, call my manager, make sure it's all right.
You know, we promised you direct access. It's 10:25, and we may see how long we go here on a school night, but let's open it up to the floor for questions. Yes, sir.
I have a two-part one. One is, I spoke to Frank earlier about the wonderful technique on the bass, because it was has such a presence, and so he filled me in, and he shared how he differed from his contemporaries in the way he mic'd the bass, and so maybe the rest of the people like to hear that. And the second one is Old Blue Eyes. I'd like to know more about recording with him.
You'd like to know more about recording with Old Blue Eyes. We never talked about Old Blue Eyes. We talked.
Frank Sinatra.
Recording what?
With Old Blue Eyes, Frank Sinatra.
Oh, okay.
And one of the things I understand about Frank is that he was extremely loyal, but very easily offended. So it might be interesting to know a little bit about him in recording.
So the first question was your methods of recording bass, because the bass was, I mean, its definition, depth, clarity, presence was striking.
Well, no question, in those days, singers and most people in the theater, diction is very important. I don't want to mention about today's diction on records and tape and whatever, because I have not understood any of it. So, but it's so important. I don't know why they keep throwing the language out the window, but that's what made them. Sinatra's the same way. Every word you understand. So, but it was that time. Now it's this time. As far as working with Frank Sinatra, I was thrilled. I always enjoyed him. I always loved to listen to his records. And I was fascinated of him as a person. I mean, what he went through in his lifetime, not too many other people can make that statement. But when he finally got to me, he was right, just a nice, nice man, very quiet, relaxed, anxious to please. And so we had a good connection, the two of us, he being Italian and I'm Italian, so I guess it just came all together. We had a good time working with each other. I did 6 albums with him, and that New York, New York, I enjoyed it, but you know, if you saw, bought the record, it's West Coast engineer. Frank used to do that when he recorded in New York or wherever. He agreed, oh, everything's fine, but then he'd go back out and play with it. And if he decided he wanted to change it, he changed it. So he did. He gave it to, I don't remember his name, but I had a great time doing it. He was a gentleman all the way.
What about the first part, the first question about recording the bass? Because it was striking, like on the T.O. track, the ways that you recorded the acoustic bass and how that differed from what was common practice in your time.
Well, I was just telling that gentleman there, I used a microphone. The bass opening is there, and I put a microphone out about this far.
Not and under the bridge.
They would pick away at it, and I was always a lover of bass, and so I worked hard to. Every bass sound is different, and I knew all the guys, very, very close friends I made of them, and so I, while they're talking and running down a tune, I'd be listening to the bass, and I, if I had to, I would equalize. I didn't have to tell them, but when we had the playback, I'd go out and stand alongside and listen with the rest of them, and invariably, I never had a bass player tell me the sound was bad. And I was telling him that in those days, a lot of the engineers used small, thin, cheap microphones, taped it right to
the bridge.
Yeah, and you get what you get. Yeah, so I never did that. I always mic'd it. I wasn't concerned about leaking into any other mic. That's what the music is for. They all had to be heard in their own environment, and that was my interest in doing it that way.
Interesting.
And I didn't always use the same microphone either, because every bass sounds different. So I make my choice when I listen.
I see. Yes.
Frank, how did you mic the violins?
Well, it just depends how many.
What would be, for full section sound,
yeah.
Did they have like a minimum of maybe seven or?
Well, usually it'd be six first, six seconds, and the rest. It usually be around 14, 16. Then you have the bass cellos. In those days, we didn't have a lot of microphones, so I started first row on the floor, the second row on a riser, third row behind them, then another riser. And as I was telling Tom here, I'd put the microphone, it would be roughly between 15 and 20 feet, I guess. Just the one microphone. Get the whole section. And you have to listen. And so when I, as I said before, I listened. So as I'm listening, and I decided, well, mic is too high or too low or over too far, I go out and make a change. Go back in and listen some more until I finally became comfortable and I let it go. So, and I used Neumann 49 on the strings. Most engineers were using the 67, which I didn't care for strings at all. Everything sizzled. So I stayed with it until I had to do some other kind of music, and then I would change. We did, way back early, Bob asked me about it. I had mentioned in his recording of me in the car that when we only had eight positions and we have full string section and everything else, and then they threw in a chorus, vocal chorus. I didn't have any more microphones. So another high rise in back, put them behind the strings, raised the mic maybe another foot, and recorded them on the same string mic. But you had to get the balance then. You couldn't overshoot them, so that's the way I did it.
Wow.
I know it's kind of a follow-up, but on the Percy Faith, you know, that sound.
Yeah. That was a lot of echo, too. Yeah. But he was easy to work with. His charts were so, you know, no problem with them. It was great.
You know, Frank made me think of something, I'll give you just a second, that I mentioned I did an article for Stereophile recently where I was in a number of studios in New York, one of which was Systems 2 in Brooklyn, a great studio where an engineer named Joe Marciano works exclusively with jazz and gets great results. And he said what you just said, that when I asked him how he gets his great results, he said he's got to go out in the room first and listen.
Right.
It's so obvious. And he says, but you'd be amazed how other engineers will come into his studio, because other engineers will work there, and they never go out in the room. They're behind the board the whole time.
I know.
They're not out in the room and then go back and try to get the sound they just heard. It's so obvious that people miss it.
I thought I indicated that when I said, you must listen. You can't just get in, put up a microphone and turn it on, and it's the wrong way to do it. You have to listen, and it's best if you go out, even if they're rehearsing. I've been in that studio when it was empty hundreds of times, so I knew where I was when I was in there. But I would go out, I'd hear it on mic, and then I'd go out and listen in the room. Yeah, yeah. You get another picture.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, Robert.
Frank, a trivia question here. Do you happen to remember the speaker and the microphone used in the echo chamber?
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Of course, sure. Well, I think at that first time, I wound up with a 67. Neumann 67, Telefunken, whatever you call them nowadays. And I never liked the microphone, and I said to myself, why'd you put it in there? So I didn't like it. And the next time I had time, free time, so I could go down and put a different microphone and listen to it. And I think I wound up with I can't remember. I really can't remember. The speaker was an Altec speaker. Not that size, but close to it. And the main thing was to control the amount going into the chamber so that you don't distort or cause other problems. And then, of course, you took the output as much as you wanted on any mic position or overall, however you're going to use it. And you listen, and I had to be pleased with what I'm hearing before I would say, yes, that's it. And that's how nothing sharp or technical or anything, it was just my ears that determined what I wanted to do. And at one point I had excellent hearing, but it's gone like everything else. So, anything else?
Yeah. How did you get the excellent piano sound on Tony Bennett, San Francisco? Is that a mix of technique of the...
You appreciate that.
Yeah, that was really nice sound.
Yeah. Well, first off, you need a piano that responds nicely. And we had that. It was a masterwork, a classical piano, big one. And then, of course, after that, it's up to you. I've had engineers and pianists that like to put the microphones right close to the strings. And, well, that was never my... Just like I don't like isolation, I always... the microphones out here, top up, and put them where I thought would be best, and that's how I did it. Even with orchestra, didn't matter. So, I did Ferranti and Teicher. You heard that name, anybody? They sold a lot of piano records. And when they first came, he said, we've heard your records and we like them. Do ours? I said, I'll do what I can. I don't know if I can please you. They said, well, okay. So I said, why don't you tell me how the records you sold, who mic'd them? I don't have to know who, but where were the mics? So they told me right smack on the keys. So I said, oh, okay. All right, let's record it that way. We recorded it. Now I said, my turn? Sure, you want to do differently. I said, I want you to hear what I think you should do. And that's what I did. I pulled the mics out, and they're looking at me like this. And I said, just relax. So they played the same tune, and I played one against the other. And even they admitted that the way I was miking them is much better than what they had been listening to all those years. So
I'd forgotten those names.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, they were a piano duo. Right?
Yeah, 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 it was like they were hitting the keys with a hammer. It sounded, and lots of compression also on their original records. So anyway, that was that one.
Interesting.
Give me a hard one.
Frank, here's a hard one.
Okay.
Maybe. Who was the pianist who was on the Tony Bennett of San Francisco? And the reason I'm asking is, well, one, curiosity about actually who it was, but also it sounded similar to the pianist on Johnny Mathis, some of the Johnny Mathis stuff.
It could easily have been.
And,
but Tony was, man, I had his name on my tongue while you were talking.
Ralph Sharon?
Ralph Sharon. Yeah. Did you say that? Yeah. Ralph Sharon, a great pianist, and nice, also a nice person. So, but there were some great pianists in New York that were just part of the recording group of musicians. There were some great, great, real great pianists, musicians, everything. We had the best of everything at that time. There was one other that exceptional. Now, if I could just remember his name. Well, give me a minute. It'll come. It'll come. He was also a trained classical pianist. And every session that I had in the morning, there were two musicians that would follow me in the door, an hour and a half ahead of everyone else. Oh, Dick Hyman. Anyone know Dick Hyman?
Yeah.
Okay. And the other was Bucky Pizzarelli, the guitarist.
Oh, yeah.
And they, Dick would sit at the piano, have his breakfast, read New York Times, and just run along, keep. And Bucky was the same way. He'd sit there playing, playing, playing. And you hear it in their playing. I mean, it's not something they just picked up. Yeah. They trained themselves for it. And it's so important. You can't fool. I don't think you can. People understand. And so, and also, financially, those guys always were wanted on sessions. You know, the contractors would book the sessions. The company never did that. And the contractors are smart. They know who wants certain musicians, and every time that musician would be there. So it was a fun time, it really was. And they were great people.
Huh. Anybody have a real curveball for Frank?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the biggest mistake you've ever made?
What?
What's the biggest mistake you ever made, musically or sexually?
Part of your career or part of a session?
My biggest mistake?
Yeah.
In my career?
Or as part of a session?
Well, maybe the mistake was staying with Columbia all those years. I could use the money now that I let get by me way back then. No, but I didn't have any. I was so happy. It sounds strange, but I was. All my best friends, they'd go to work grudgingly. They didn't want to go to work, and I'd be getting home 2 or 3 in the morning and leaving again at 8 with a smile on my face. It was just, for me, it was life itself. So I wish more people had that reaction.
Yes.
I have a question. In those years when the Beatles came in and Elvis Presley, how does it react their approach to your side of music? How that did you feel?
Well,
that? What did you see?
When you say how do they react, who are you talking about?
Like Beatles and Elvis Presley.
In rock and roll,
basically. Oh,
huh?
Oh, yeah.
What was the impact that had on your world all of a sudden?
For me, it was almost murder. I mean, I couldn't understand why everybody was so happy to hear it, but I tried, you know, in the record business, you get people that either they don't have ability to create a sound of their own, and they hear that, and they say, I want to sound like that. Well, you can't just do it. It's impossible. I'm in a studio and it's got acoustics. They record in some little garage or basement or whatever, and you can't duplicate that. I don't care who you are. So, yeah, that was, for me, it was the start of the downgrade of good music. I hate to say it that way, but that's the way I felt. So, and it's still here. That music is still here. Earlier I said diction, impossible. You can't understand a word they say. Can you understand them?
With the lyric sheet, it helps.
Yeah, right, absolutely. But
no, why the words.
I'm from a different world, and I enjoyed mine.
Another question. During your working days, just the daily operation, have you had a chance to go to the concert and see somebody's performance?
Oh, I always...
Orchestra, like classical music.
Did I ever go to hear them live in performance?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
All the time. That's the only way to listen to music. I mean, recordings are great, but you want excitement, you go.
With your family or just by yourself?
My wife is always interested in music. She listens. My kids, my son and daughter both play piano. And my daughter got into college, and she came home one day and said, Dad, can you get me a nice acoustic guitar? I want to learn to play guitar. Mm-hmm. So I said, all right. So I get into New York. I asked 3 or 4 of my friends in the guitar section, and they said, sure, we'll get it. And they came in and gave it to me one day. They went into Manny's music store in Midtown, a beautiful sounding instrument. She played so good. I made the mistake at one time when she was home, you know, and that you're playing so beautifully with so much feeling, and I think you should start taking lessons. 3 months later, she calls from school, you know, Dad, I don't think I want to play guitar anymore. And she never played it again. So strange. My son, who played beautiful piano with feeling, same thing. He gets into college, never played another note. So I don't know what they do to them in college.
I tell you, but it takes too long.
So,
and it's called
Academy
system, stereo system, like playback the records at home.
I had all kinds of records at home. My children were just getting up there when rock and roll came. I took all the rock and roll I could get my hands on, all the other things, jazz, whatever. Play what you want, listen. That's the main thing. Listen and make your own decision what you like. And that's what happened. I never forced them to listen to anything. So my wife was an avid listener of music. She just loves music. And so she enjoyed everything. She listened to rock. I never do, but she does. All right. Anything? uh-oh, the brains are here.
On all of Columbia's output during your era, they had something on the labels that said, I think, stereo 360-degree sounds.
Oh, yes.
What was that?
That was supposed to be surround sound. That fellow that you had here, I don't remember his
Huber.
Name.
David Mouse Huber.
Who?
Oh, yeah.
Huber.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel any different listening to him than I did when we first started surround sound in New York. The problem there was there was no thought given to surround sound. They just booked musicians and whatever, and we still had to do four tunes. How could you develop surround sound without getting involved with the placement of musicians, and the music had to be scored so that there is, you can feel and hear a change from one thing to another. So they never really were serious about doing it. Lasted maybe 6 months, and then we never did another one. So, but I don't quite understand. He was very enthused, and I appreciated him when he talked about it. But then he went into detail how long it took him to complete a record. And here we were trying to do it in three-hour sessions. And what do you learn in that period of time? No, not good.
Yes.
Did you ever, since we're talking about surround, did you ever actually work on any quad recordings?
Yeah, sure. Oh, sure. Again, that was the same thing.
Oh, no.
I don't want you to misunderstand. Columbia, they were always following. They were not a leader in some instances. And quad was another. The producers in the classical department, they wanted us to make quad. But you don't just make quad at the console. It's got to be done in the studio. And there again, it was so disappointing. But once you're just an employee, you just keep quiet. That's what we did.
Did you ever do any electronic music? I thought I read somewhere you did some, I don't know if it was Babbitt or any of those guys.
I recorded all that stuff.
How?
But
I mean, you didn't set up an orchestra, did you?
No. Well, I'm trying to figure out what you're getting to.
Well,
when we had sessions,
yeah.
And here come 2, 3, 4 guitarists on that session with everything else, you have to find out what each one was doing in order to put it in context on tape. Yeah. And so that's the only way you find out, and that's what I would do. I'd go out, ask each one of them, what parts are you playing? Who's the lead? You know, if you don't know that, then you can't mix it properly.
But they would be acoustic musicians. I mean, they'd be playing instruments, anyone, on those.
Yeah, well, those acoustic guys had to get into electric guitars, too, if they wanted to get enough sessions to survive. So they were learning just as I was.
Well, what I was getting at were, well, you know, like oscillators or synthesizers or any of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, that was usually done after the synthesizers, after then they can devote time, sit there in the control room with me or other engineers, and we'd be hearing it as they are playing and also playing against or with. And that's the only way I did it. I don't know what else.
It just seems so, you know, like a foreign language compared to, you know, having a beautiful studio, having people in there playing, and, you know,
yeah.
It
didn't last very long.
Yeah.
I hope I haven't bored you all, but I haven't had this happy feeling for a long time, and I'm enjoying it more than you all are, I'm sure. So I thank all of you. It's been so kind and enthused, and that's important. It's great. And this gentleman here, he's caught on. You did a great job with GNU, Roy.
Oh, Roy.
Yeah, I thought he was going to be here tonight.
Yeah, we were expecting Roy. I don't.
Oh. Okay. All right. Well, it's up to you all to call it a night. Unless you want to stay. I have a private chauffeur there. I have to ask him if he can stay later. That's great.
Well, thank you all so much. You've been a great audience as always. And I've had
a
wonderful time this evening. It's been fascinating for me to just sit next to this guy and share his life and his memories. It's been really great. Thank you so much for having me. And we may have burned the Northwest out of its great engineers. I don't know, we've got to move on to another genre maybe, Mike. I don't know. Microphone manufacturers
perhaps
or something. So. Not as interesting, though.
There's always something else.
There's always something.
Yeah. You were great. I appreciate
thank
it.
You so much.
Well, for those of you who wondered why I have this and I stumble, I had brain surgery 2 weeks ago. And
well, I could never qualify for that.
Far from 100%. Oh, I thought you were going to say I didn't know you had a brain.
If I only had a brain.
Oh, dear.
They leave this thing in, Frank? They leave this shunt in?
Oh, yeah.